just sang, friends through fear, Jesus has caused disowning. And that's Peter. And we're looking at 1 Peter chapter 5 this morning. The disciple who was humbled when Christ was suffering. As he said, he was a witness of the sufferings of Christ, is chapter 5, verse 1. This morning, we're looking at verse 5 of chapter 5 in 1 Peter. And throughout this letter, one of the things we've learned, we haven't talked about in a little while, but one of the things that we've seen in Peter's communication style is he often starts with an imperative, and then he follows it by the indicative, or he gives a command and then follows it with the theological ground for that command. Simply put, do this for that reason. And in the text this morning, we have a singular imperative that's going to take kind of the theme of the message, and that's in verse 5. The imperative is, clothe yourselves with humility toward each other. And then the theological ground for that command is because God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Now, as you look at verse 5, you may say, well, I'm seeing three imperatives. Likewise, you younger people, number one, submit yourselves to your elders. And in our New King James translation, yes, all of you. Number two, be submissive to one another. And number three, be clothed with humility. And there are three imperatives here, but I want to sort of gently lay aside two of them for a moment so that the third can sort of rise to the theme of our message this morning. The first one, submit to your elders, directed to the younger people. Upon further study, and as Pastor Matt and I were reflecting on this past week, kind of doing our sermon preparation, we're like, that really is best placed with the previous message to elders. It's application to the young people and how to respond to elders. Now, we're going to address it today, particularly as application, but as an imperative, it takes a little bit of a second chair this morning. And the second one, yes, all of you, be submissive to one another, is a textual variant. If you're reading another translation than the King James and New King James this morning, then you probably don't have it there in front of you. Textual variant, something that's found in some Greek manuscripts and not in others. And so in this case, both the context of what Peter's discussing and the manuscript evidence are indicating, they're going to point to us that the original probably did not contain this command to everyone to be submissive to each other. Contextually speaking, every time that Peter has used this idea of submission, and he's used it quite a bit, there was always the intent behind it of an authority structure. The follower follows the leader. Citizens to government, servants to masters, wives to husbands, youngers to elders. So for Peter now to say, okay, now everyone follow each other within the church, could be easily misunderstood to kind of undo some of the things he was just establishing as far as the ecclesiastical structure of the church. How do we all follow each other? How do parents follow the children? How do elders follow the youngers? So if this command is original, then Peter is qualifying it with the next command, submit to each other in this way, which would be using submission in a different way than he has before, but submit by clothing yourselves with humility. So we're left with this third and primary command, be clothed with humility. And it's important that we note the sphere or the realm in which this command should be applied. It is all of you to one another. Posture yourselves with lowliness in every relationship within the community of faith. So the message this morning is quite simple. God desires humble service to characterize every relationship within the church. Why is that? Well, that's the theological ground. The indicative that we talked about a moment ago. So on this occasion, what Peter does is he quotes Solomon. This is a proverb, Proverbs 3. And he does so masterfully because Solomon is also describing a situation where he's addressing life in the community, much like Peter's doing, with the same imperative indicative style. So if you would look with me at Proverbs 3, that's where we're going to spend most of our time this morning, to understand why Peter's quoting this and how it fits into the context of 1 Peter 5, verse 5. So Proverbs chapter 3. Now, as you're turning there, you may be expecting, as I was, the fact that, I mean, much of Proverbs is just these short, punchy statements that sort of march staccato, one after another. So this is a proverb, here's a proverb, here's a proverb. Here's wisdom, here's folly. Here's a good way to use your money, here's a bad way. Here's a good way to talk, here's a bad way to talk. Listen, don't, you know, like all of these things. Anger, self-control, it just sort of goes one after another. But here in this first third of the book, through about chapter 9, there's longer lectures from Solomon to his son. And our text lands in one of these longer lectures. So wisdom literature is already written in this very straightforward, graphic, street smart language, so it doesn't need a ton of explanation. I'll try not to beat it to death as we walk through it. So look with me at these words of wisdom. Proverbs chapter 3, starting in verse 21. My son, let them not depart from your eyes. Keep sound wisdom and discretion. So they will be life to your soul and grace to your neck. And you will walk safely in your way, and your foot will not stumble. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. Yes, you will lie down, and your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden terror, nor of trouble from the wicked when it comes. For the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught. Now, pay close attention, particularly from here on out. Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due, when it is in the power of your hand to do so. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I will give it, when you have it with you. Do not devise evil against your neighbor, for he dwells by you for safety's sake. Do not strive with a man without cause, if he has done you no harm. Do not envy the oppressor and choose none of his ways. For the perverse person is an abomination to the Lord, but his secret counsel is with the upright. The curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the home of the just. Surely he scorns the scornful, but gives grace to the humble. The wise shall inherit glory, but shame shall be the legacy of fools. So, a few observations. Solomon. Solomon starts out, just look with me at this text. I think it helps to have the visual, so I'm going to use a bit of a visual this morning. Five commands. Every verse, 27, 28, 29, 30, and 31, all start in the exact same way. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. Sounds like a parent. And he is. He's writing to his son, to his youth. So here's our list of commands, the list of imperatives, already patterning Peter, or Peter patterning Solomon. The first line of every of these pairs establishes the command, right? So don't, explanation. And then the second line always gives a qualification to the command. When this, when that, because this, if that, and a second idea. So this second line always is supporting the command. Also note the sphere of these relationships. Much like in Peter, he says, all of you to one another, the community of faith. And here, Solomon is writing regarding interactions with your neighbor. Don't devise evil against your neighbor. Why? Because this is a person who dwells beside you, trustingly or for safety's sake. So it's the same sphere, community relationships, the same style, similar imperatives. So let's just step through these briefly. Don't withhold good from those to whom it is due. Okay, so again, straightforward. But when someone within the community has a need, don't hesitate to offer them good, an answer, a solution to that need. Perhaps an object like money or a lawnmower or a vehicle. Perhaps something you have that they might need. Or it might be an action, not an object, like lending your strength or helping them seek justice or babysitting. Things like this. Good things that we can offer to each other action-wise. It might even be, probably most commonly is, an area of expertise. You know, the guy that has the truck and the trailer. That happened within our church family a couple times this week, myself included. It could be the person like the mechanic. Andres, right? He gets all sorts of questions about cars because he's a mechanic. He can offer his expertise. The handyman, whatever it might be. We can offer these things that we have, objects, actions, or expertise, to the community. Now, if we're not on guard, that can easily frustrate and discourage us, right? The pianist doesn't always want to be asked to play the piano type of a thing. The truck guy doesn't always want to be asked to use his truck. So there's a couple things that can help make this happen. One, don't take advantage of your neighbors and their gifts. And two, from your own standpoint, view what you have as something that's not actually intended for you, but is intended to bless your community. We learned that previously in Peter. You've been given gifts from the diverse storehouse of God's giftedness so that you can bless the people around you. Now, what's our qualifier? When it's in the power of your hand to do so. So give from what you have. Much like Peter said earlier, God gifted you, so use it to gift others. If you don't have the ability to help, there's no moral or communal obligation to help. Quite simple, quite straightforward. Verse 28, don't say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I will give it when you have it with you. So now Solomon's describing not only what we do, but how we do it. We should give quickly. We should give without hesitation. After all, when we say, why don't you come back tomorrow? Normally, we're hoping that they won't. We're trying to avoid, it's much like a sales technique, right? If you can hang up with the salesman, then it's hopefully over. And this just addresses, you know, our tendency or temptation to delay, really, to get out of doing something altogether. So whether this hesitation is motivated perhaps by greed or by laziness or by indifference to the needs of someone else, or simply because you like having your nice stuff and you don't want it to be worn or broken by somebody, whatever it might be prepared to be generous. Again, the qualifier, when you have it with you. So if you don't have the ability to help, then saying so makes perfect sense. So these two commands go together. If you've been in our Psalms class, this is what would be a quatrain. This is a set of four lines, poetically, that work well together. And they refer really to the same scenario, right? How to respond when someone needs help. So if we as a church family failed to follow this first pair of commands, then we would not be doing something we ought to be doing. Theologically speaking, that would be a sin of omission. Not doing something you are called to do. Second pair of commands, verse 29. Don't devise evil against your neighbor because he dwells by you for safety's sake. So this idea of devise is a really cool word. It's what a woodworker does when he is cutting the wood. He is devising the wood. He's preparing it. It's what a gardener does when they devise the soil. They're preparing the soil. They have a plan, and they're putting that plan into action by devising it. So don't make plans that will harm the life of your neighbor. A wise person is going to do that which benefits the community, even if it costs him, and it will. That's what he's saying. You will give, which means you probably won't have something that you gave. It will cost you. A foolish person is going to do that which benefits himself, even if it costs the community. So don't plot evil against your neighbor. Why? What's the qualifier? Because he dwells by you for safety's sake. And he's not saying there that he's dwelling by you because you're like his bodyguard, you're keeping him safe, though there's a little bit of that that happens within a neighborhood. You're kind of watching out for each other. But he's saying he trusts you. He's not watching his back. He relies upon you. There's no reason that you would do him evil because he hasn't done evil to you. If they had sinned against you, they might be looking for retribution. But in this case, he hasn't. So neighbors in a right relationship have no reason to suspect treachery from each other. And a Christian church should be the exact same. We have no reason to expect treachery from each other. Once a neighbor acts maliciously, what's planted in the community? Distrust, suspicion, uncertainty. And that happens in churches all the time. Don't devise evil against your neighbor because they trust you. Verse 30, don't strive with a man without cause if he has done you no harm. So generally, this striving is a verbal thing. It's bringing a complaint against someone or bringing an accusation against them, stirring up trouble, starting drama, reading into someone's comments or their actions without giving them the benefit of the doubt, as 1 Corinthians 13 would teach us that love does. Don't do these things. Don't strive with people. Qualifier, if they have done you no harm. Meaning, there may be a time that not to stir up trouble, but to make an appropriate accusation. This is the idea of Matthew 18. If there is an offense, then you go appropriately to this person to seek to reconcile, to make it right. You communicate. But when there has been no harm done, don't go at each other. As we learned previously in Peter, love covers a multitude of sins. So these second two commands work together as well. Second quatrain. If we as a church family failed to follow this second pair of commands, then we would be doing something that we should not do. That's a sin of commission. So the first is not doing something you should. And the second pair is doing something that you ought not. Let's look at this last one, finally, in verse 31. Do not envy the oppressor and choose none of his ways. So the pattern breaks. Right now we're no longer talking about your interaction with your good neighbors. We're talking about the interaction with the bad one, the oppressor. And he says, don't envy them. Now, who are these people? Who are the oppressors? People in the community who are doing the previous four things. These are the oppressors. The oppressors withhold good. Oppressors turn their neighbors away. Oppressors plan hurtful things. Oppressors make accusations against their neighbors. They're motivated by this love of self and remain indifferent to the thoughts and feelings of other people. Psalm 73 describes them this way. He says, for I was envious of the boastful, these oppressors, when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no pangs in their death, but their strength is firm. They're not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like other men. Therefore, pride serves as their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes bulge with abundance. They have more than heart could wish. They scoff and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue walks through the earth. Behold, these are the ungodly, who are always at ease. They increase in riches. And the temptation for us, there's this surface attraction to the life of the oppressor. After all, it appears that people who are willing to push others around or seek themselves and their own first above the needs of the community, they get what they want. And you see that all over the world. That you see the people who are willing to make the stand for themselves, do their own thing, not really care what it's going to cost other people, they tend to be more successful in this life. But we are not to envy them. We are not to look at them and their more money and their increased power that they have. Time spent, you know, wishfully glancing at these people and their mirage of magnificence, these things that seem so good on the surface, is time that's wasted. And he's about to explain why. But one more note, the qualifier of verse 31, and choose none of his ways. So not only should we avoid this mental, emotional trap of envying them, we must never imitate them. Do not set your foot in the path of the fool. Choose none of his ways. Do not study any of his tactics. Do not treat people the way that he treats people. And can you not hear just this kind of crescendo of offenses? First, it's just not giving somebody something. You should do that, but you didn't. And then it's actually turning into someone who's plotting against and taking action against your neighbor. And now, finally, we got to be careful that we don't turn into the oppressor. There's this build that Solomon is using poetically to describe offenses within the community. And then he gives us, as we've been waiting for, the theological ground, the why. And that is right here. For, because, and then he explains four comparisons, one in each verse, 32, 33, 34, 35, four comparisons between these good neighbors and these oppressive neighbors. So we have the perverse, we have the wicked, we have the scornful, and the fool. Four descriptions of this kind of a person. Immediately contrasted, again, if you're in the Psalms class, you should be seeing parallelism all over the place. The perverse person, but his secret counsel is with the upright. He blesses the home of the just. He gives grace to the humble, and the wise shall inherit glory. So each verse has this comparison between terms that's used constantly throughout the Proverbs. This binary, this wise and fool, perverse, upright, wicked, just, scornful, humble, fool, wise. And then finally, we should note in these first three verses, 32 through 34, the activity of the Lord, which ultimately is what's the most important part of this text and the text in Peter. This is the theological ground. The Lord is the theological ground for why we would do or not do certain things, because he loves and hates certain things. So the Lord and the curse of the Lord, and then he scorns scornful but gives grace to the humble. So look for these things as well as we go through. Let's briefly just walk through these four. So first, perverse and upright. Perverse are an abomination to the Lord, but his secret counsel is with the upright. Perversity, this idea of someone that is devious. So devious activity within the household, a devious person, a devious neighbor turns God's stomach. They are an abomination to him. Acting with the intent to hurt or to humiliate directly opposes the character of God. But he brings these upright neighbors into his counsel. They receive guidance and protection. The upright enter this circle of harmony, as it were, because they've received wise hearts. Verse 33, the curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the home of the just. So God's turned stomach now turns to a curse. It's not just an abomination, but he takes action against it. And this is one of the strongest ways that you can describe being against something, is this curse that God levels upon the house of the wicked. He delivers them over to misfortune, separating these people from the blessings of the of communion within this righteous community. Their house, as it were, pictures everything that they are and have, all of their blessings, all of these, their possessions, their abundance, perhaps even their family, is relegated to darkness, to the curse of the Lord. But on the other side, he blesses the home of the just. So the righteous homes receive this protection, security, and rest of the Lord, his blessing. Verse 34, surely he scorns the scornful, but gives grace to the humble. Scorners, and this is our verse in 1 Peter 5, surely he scorns the scornful, but gives grace to the humble. These scorners are ones who use their mouths to mock. This antisocial verbal oppression. It's demeaning and belittling. It's arrogant. And they are going to receive from the hand of God the very same thing that they deal out to other people. So the scorners will be scorned. Much like other times in the Psalms, the Lord laughs at the wicked. He's not intimidated by them. He's not impressed by their stuff, this temporary mound of things that they've brought together. Good for you. But he laughs because he knows their end. He scorns the scornful, but on the other side, he gives grace to the humble. These lowly ones, these humble ones are shown favor, not forgotten or abandoned to the wicked or even to a natural end, but they're seen and delivered by God. He gives grace to them. Finally, this kind of climax in the verses, this wise and the fool. These are the two main categories of Proverbs. The wise inherit glory. He also switched directions, if you notice, for this last one. He's been saying the bad one first and the good one second, and now he switches them to just show us that he's done. It says, the wise shall inherit glory, but the shame shall be the legacy of fools. So the wise receive this inheritance, this permanent share in the glory of God's family. They receive lasting honor, weight, permanence. But fools don't inherit anything. Their legacy is the shame that they have lived with and produced in their lives is now turned and brought on their own heads. They receive public disgrace and dishonor. So, that's Proverbs 3. The point is less the descriptions of the two categories and more this crystal clear declaration of God's perspective and his actions toward these two groups of people. Why should we, in Proverbs, cease from sinful divisions and disruptions within the community of faith? And why should we turn to this kind of immediate generosity and the cultivation of peace? Because God hates, curses, and scorns selfish, divisive, oppressive people. That's why. And he counsels, blesses, and acts with favor toward these giving, lowly neighbors. So as we abruptly return to 1 Peter, with Proverbs in hand, Peter's pattern and his point becomes abundantly clear. What he's saying in verse 5 is this: all of you, in your relationships within this sacred covenant, local community of faith, dress yourselves, clothe yourselves, put on humility. When you interact with each other, those sitting next to you, across from you, your family, when you interact with your neighbor, wear this godly garment of grace, humility. What is humility? Humility is a willing, lowly, servant-minded attitude. It is driven by absolute dependency on God that wholeheartedly rejects the exaltation of self and instead embraces the tremendous value of others expressed in service to others and supremely expressed in service to God. It's a willing, lowly, servant-minded attitude driven by a recognition of the absolute dependency on God that wholeheartedly rejects the exaltation of self and instead embraces the tremendous value of other people expressed in service to them and supremely expressed in service to God. That's humility. It's a perspective that says, my desires and my needs and my ideas are not supreme. They are not the most important. I do not need to elevate them or myself to get what I want. Instead, with Christ as my example, I will, as Philippians 2 says, do nothing from selfishness or conceit, but in humility, I will count myself as less important than other people. I'm not only just going to look to my own things, but I'm going to look to the interests of others. So this Christian mindset, it removes the blinders of self-sufficiency and self-exaltation. How countercultural is that? And it opens our eyes to the necessity of treating other people with respect and with compassion. The imagery that Peter uses when he says, clothe yourselves. This idea is not a beautiful, stunning garment that we put on that's just wonderful and magnificent. The idea here is the apron of a servant. It should remind us pretty quickly of another time that Peter sat with Christ, and Christ donned humility. He put on the apron of a servant, and he did something that no one else wanted to do, that was lowly. He washed his disciples' feet. As Jesus wrapped this garment of a servant around him to do the task that was beneath everyone else, so also must we clothe ourselves with humility. And remember, as we're thinking about humility, which is, it's a virtue, you could say. When we think about virtues, we often think of them as internal characteristics, internal realities. But internal realities always display themselves through actions. Just as an honest person tells the truth, or an ethical person is going to work hard, so a humble person serves their community. The virtue of humility is visibly identifiable. So this first phrase, likewise you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders, this is a great example of humility. And it does pair well. It is the conclusion, it is the application to elders who are humbly leading well. You follow them. These younger people, these young, likely in both age and in faith. Peter's exhortation here is a good example of humility, and you ought to heed it, much like Solomon cries out for his youth, for his son to follow. That's not exclusively, we just read it and talked about it together. He's not exclusively talking to people under the age of 18. He's talking to all of us. It is wisdom. So everyone, follow your elders. But he's saying and probably identifying a temptation with youth, both in age and in faith, towards pride. Scripture often identifies pride as a temptation for youth, and we experience it. So young people, or young in the faith, and everyone all together listening, when you think you know best, humble yourself and hear counsel. When a word of correction given to you, or a rebuke, as Proverbs would say, when you react against that, remind yourself that fools refuse to listen. When a word of correction rises quickly to your tongue and you want to correct someone else, well, pause. Because in too many words, there's danger, there's folly. This is a great illustration for us of what this humility might look like. So a question, a consideration, and then we'll close. This question, it's important that we answer, why is it that God opposes the proud? Why is he so against them? Why are they an abomination? Why does he curse their house? Why does he scorn them? It seems a little bit dramatic, drastic, an overreaction. A power-hungry God who just wants what he wants and doesn't like certain people, so he smushes them. Well, he responds this way. God opposes the proud because they trust in themselves when their creator delights in being trusted. The proud are on a conquest for their own glory when their Creator God delights and demands to receive glory. They are self-centered and self-sufficient. They think they are. And they oppose him. In their arrogance, they subvert and they destroy the very communities that they're intended to participate and build up. Instead of, like Solomon encouraged his son, to wear truth and wisdom around their necks, Psalm 73 said that they wear pride around their necks. Instead of being clothed with humility, they, as Psalm 73 said, wear the garment of violence. For these sins and countless more, the anger of a righteous God burns hot. From God's vantage point, they have chosen foolishly, and they will receive a terrifying end. Psalm 73 ends, it says, you drop them into ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment. They are utterly swept away by sudden terrors. Behold, those who are far from you will perish. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. So how is it that every one of us is not counted among the proud? Elect exiles. Even your humility isn't from you. You were chosen to it. You were chosen by a gracious God to be one of his humble ones. And he's given you this responsibility to live consistently now with your identity. So don't walk away this morning motivated to be a good neighbor, motivated by this law, motivated by, well, if I do this, then God does that. It's not how it works. You can't do this. Therefore, God couldn't do that for you. You cannot be a righteous one. Don't don humility to cause the grace of God to shower upon you. It's not how it works. You are unable. Instead, be drawn with affection to the greatest and the humblest and most magnificent servant of all. Fix your gaze on Christ and rejoice that you have been internally transformed by the Spirit of God. If you have been born again this morning, then you have been led with this imagery of the shepherd that Peter has just used. You've been led by a gentle shepherd to the waters of humility, where we together learn of our lack and of Christ's fullness. You were born again into a community of faith. So we sit together by this gentle stream and we learn by grace how we should see each other, how we should treat each other as image bearers and fellow heirs of the grace of life, not just quirky, broken, frustrating neighbors. So, my dear family, by God's kindness, may we see our desperate need to live consistently with Christ, who clothed himself with humility to serve us, the most undeserving. And may we get over ourselves so that we can practice this kind of immediate generosity and this culture, learn to cultivate peace within our family, because that's what God has called us to do. That's what's consistent. That is Christian. That is Christ-like. And it's only possible through him. So may God help us to do this so that we don't play the fool. And we don't treat Jesus' bride like his enemies treat her.